off from the grind of training. Having a full day off meant the Spec Ops teams could train even harder on days when they weren't working in the galley. Doing something challenging and unfamiliar together was great for team bonding. Depending on how long our mission lasted, I considered eventually breaking up national teams and scattering people into multinational teams. Eventually, if we survived that long.
Afternoon, Colonel. Desai gestured for me to sit down at a table.
How is flight training going? Training other pilots took up most of her time, and it didn't help that I insisted she be at the controls whenever we jumped into a new star system. In that star system where Skippy was sure we'd find an Elder site but came up empty, we'd had 9 days of making short jumps and maneuvering the Dutchman in normal space to establish orbit around various planets and to explore the system's extensive asteroid field. At Desai's insistence, since we felt that isolated star system was safe from us being discovered, we took the opportunity for pilots to practice flying the Flower and dropships. The Flower spent several days away from its mother ship, jumping on its own, trying to hit specific targets on each short jump, dropping down into low orbit around planets, climbing out to jump distance, practicing space combat maneuvers. Dropships practiced landing on moons and asteroids, flying between the Dutchman and the Flower, and the pilots had great fun in mock combat, dropship against dropship. The Spec Ops troops, with me, Chang, and Adams, practiced free flight maneuvers outside the Dutchman. We took the opportunity for extending combat training sessions on airless moons, trying out different tactics in the unfamiliar alien armored suits. That week, while Skippy became increasingly frustrated about not finding an Elder site that should have been there, was great fun for the humans. The science team got full use of the Flying Dutchman's sophisticated sensors to explore a new star system. The pilots got to fling a Krestang frigate and Theranan dropships around in extreme maneuvers, testing the limits of themselves and the spacecraft, and ground troops, including me, got to fly around in spacesuits, race across the surface of low-gravity moons, play in war games, and learn in what did and didn't work. It had been by far the best 9 days of the mission. Now it was time to digest what we'd learned, share information with each other. And time for a grumpy Skippy to perform extensive maintenance on the two starships, our dropships, and our Krestang armor suits, which had suffered abuse during our week of fun.
Flight training? We're back to basic maneuvers. We got sloppy last week. We developed bad habits.
Fun, though, I said with a grin. Wasn't it?
Oh, she laughed. Yes, the most fun I've had since I learned to fly. Burning the Flower's engine to fling it on a low pass over a moon at 8 G's?
She shook her head gleefully.
Nothing compares to that. The Dutchman is a much better tool for traveling between stars, but she's an ungainly pig in normal space.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I have a question. Can you teach me to fly?
Teach you to fly?
She said it slowly, as if she wasn't sure she'd heard me correctly. The basics. I've been training with our special forces. I'm not good enough to be one of them, and I haven't trained with any team long enough to be useful. The reason I'm doing that is to understand the tactics and capabilities of each team. If I ever order them to do something, I will be informed about what they can do and how. Skippy's little tutorial on space combat maneuvers opened my eyes to how much I don't know about spaceflight and how dangerous that is. If we ever get into space combat, I want to know what our ships can do and how they do it. I took a sip of coffee. If we are ever short-handed, like when we raided that asteroid on our first mission, it would be useful for me to fill in as a co-pilot. And also there may be situations where, I looked around the galley and lowered my voice, I don't want to ask someone else to go on a mission. Situations where taking a pilot with me is only putting another person at risk. You know what I mean, Desai. She knew. She frowned and gave me a brief, wordless nod of her head.
Do you have any flying experience at all?
None. Never taken a flight lesson, not even a ride in a single-engine plane.
Good, she announced to my surprise. You won't have any habits to unlearn. Flight training on Earth is all about aerodynamics, using airspeed to create lift. That doesn't apply out here, not even when you're flying a dropship in an atmosphere. When I got to Camp Alpha for flight training, I thought being a helicopter pilot would be an advantage in flying a vertical takeoff ship like a Buzzard. I was wrong. Even a helicopter applies the principles of aerodynamics to fly, The rotor blades act as wings.
There is a saying, she smiled, that helicopters don't use aerodynamics to fly, they just beat the air into submission. With dropships and aircraft like the Buzzard, that isn't a joke. Their jets are powerful enough to hover even at high altitude, and they don't rely on wings generating lift to keep them in the air. Dropships spend most of their time in vacuum anyway. Aerodynamics aren't a factor at all. Not having to learn the principles of aerodynamics will save a tremendous amount of time.
You want to learn to fly, then?
The basics, yes. Enough for emergencies. Can you do that? Teach me? She took a sip of tea and thought a minute. I appreciated that she put thought into it rather than merely indulging the whim of her commanding officer.
We can try. Basic maneuvers in space are not all that difficult. It's the navigation that is tricky, particularly orbital mechanics. We will start with the dropship first. If you get that, we'll move on to the Flower.
Our stolen frigate is nimble. She flies like a large dropship.
I'm sending you, she tapped her iPad, a list of training courses.
I suppressed a groan. More training materials to read. Great. I can't wait to get started. Thank you, Captain Desai.
You are welcome, Colonel Bishop.
My flight training did not take up much of Desai's time, because when Skippy discovered that I wanted to learn how to fly, he insisted on training me personally. He wasn't being nice, of course, because me learning how to pilot a dropship gave him endless material for amusement and a whole new arena to insult me and question my intelligence. Unfortunately for him, I took the training very seriously. As Desai had explained, because I was starting from absolute zero, I didn't have any habits or preconceived notions to overcome. Even reading the training material was interesting. The whole subject was new to me. I spent a lot of time in a simulator, making egregious mistakes and listening to Skippy belittle me. The crew, especially my XO, appreciated me being super busy with flight training. It meant I was out of the way and not interfering with the proper operation of the ship. For me, it meant my hours, when not taking duty shifts on the bridge and training with the Spec Ops teams, was taken up by intensive learning of a subject totally new to me. It also meant that, darn it, I did not have time to take the officer training courses that I was already behind on. Every night, or morning, or afternoon, depending on my duty shift schedule, I was so tired that I fell into dreamless slumber as soon as my head hit the pillow. Good times. Before the final jump approaching our first of the new set of targets, we tried programming another jump by ourselves without Skippy's help. Before we went into action, we wanted to know whether there was any possibility we could handle the ship on our own. This time we spent only one full day calculating which coordinates to program into the navigation computer. Our science team was somewhat more confident this time than on their first try. Skippy's PowerPoint presentation about what had gone wrong the first time we programmed a jump had indeed dazzled our brilliant science team, particularly the part where he pointed out that the speed of light was a variable and that technically the ship emerged on the other side of a jump slightly before initiating a jump. That last part blew my mind. Anyway, Major Sims was in the command chair for this jump. It was her duty shift. I stood beside the command chair and tried not to interfere. Like that was going to happen.
All systems report ready for jump, Desai reported from the left-hand pilot seat.
Until we figured out how to jump correctly, our most experienced pilot was going to be at the helm for all jumps programmed by humans.
Engage jump countdown, Sims ordered.
This is exciting, Skippy said. To bed, bath, and beyond.
Sims and I shared a glance.
I think you mean to infinity and beyond, Skippy, I said.
No, I figured we'd start with something small. Infinity is too ambitious for monkeys.
I didn't respond, as the jump countdown timer on the display read 3, 2, 1. And we jumped, from one empty region of interstellar space to another.
Jump successful, Desai reported. Calculating our position now.
Ah, you'll take forever. I can't stand the suspense. We emerged within 50,000 kilometers of the target,
Skippy announced cheerily. Our goal for this jump was to be within 100,000 kilometers.
Good monkeys, great job, bananas for everyone.
Skippy, I admonished him. Be nice for a change.
What? Monkeys love bananas.
I did like bananas. Couldn't argue with him there.
Chapter 10 The actual final jump was programmed by Skippy. It took us just outside the target star system, which had a rather common and uninteresting red dwarf star, with three planets, a rocky inner planet, and two gas giants. None of the planets were anything special. What Skippy found interesting there were signs the red dwarf star used to be a Class K star, which is a larger orange star. How it went from a Class K to a red dwarf, Skippy thought, might have involved manipulation by the elders. He said sometimes when the elders needed a lot of energy for a project, they would extract it from an unimportant star that nobody needed. So Skippy thought the elders might have had a research facility or monitoring station there. Back when the elders still inhabited the galaxy in physical form, something about force lines or some damn thing he tried to explain that I hadn't understood and even had our scientists scratching their heads, meant this star system would have been an especially good place to locate a communications node. That was why we were checking out a star system that was so boringly ordinary. Around three-quarters of all the stars in the galaxy were red dwarfs. Colonel Chang's voice came over the bridge speakers. Dutchman, this is Flower. We are ready for jump. Roger, Flower. Good luck, and be careful. Especially the careful part. The little frigate would be jumping into the star system to recon the place without putting the Flying Dutchman at risk. Understood. We will take all precautions. Skippy had preloaded the Flower's navigation system with multiple jump options in case of trouble. Be back as soon as we can. On the display, the Flower disappeared in a brief flash of gamma rays. Chang had taken her out with Desai as the chief pilot. If they got into trouble, I wanted Chang to have our most experienced pilot with him. The Dutchman would be fine without Desai. We were in deep space with plenty of pilots, and Skippy aboard if anything went wrong. The mission was simple. It should be safe. Jump in near the second planet, because Skippy thought the most likely place the Elders would have had a base is on a moon circling the second planet. Jump in, first scan for ships, then scan for artificial activity anywhere near the planet. If ships or any signs of hostile intelligent life are detected, immediately jump back to the Dutchman, and we would both get the hell out of there. If nothing dangerous is detected, scan the moons for signs of any sort of Elder facility. Skippy thought we'd have much better luck finding signs of an Elder base using the more sophisticated sensors aboard the Flying Dutchman. The Flower would only be looking for anything obvious. It should be easy. It should be safe. It worried the hell out of me. Our partly beat-up, second-hand, stolen Kristang frigate, relying on technology the lizards had stolen from higher-tech species and didn't quite understand, was out there all alone, without Skippy to guide them. Detaching the frigate to recon the target had been Chang's idea. We had discussed it at length, me arguing against it, until I had to give up and concede that Chang was absolutely right. Risking the Flower was preferable to risking the Dutchman. Aboard the frigate was a nuke for Chang to use for destroying his ship if it was at risk of being captured. Our nukes were each encased in the jacket of contaminants that, according to Skippy and our scientists, would conceal the human origin of the devices. Apparently, the chemical or atomic makeup of a nuclear device was like a fingerprint. It would point right back to who had made it and when, even the particular facility that generated the material. All of that was news to me. I thought a nuke was a nuke. Thinking about the Flower self-destructing was not helping my anxiety as time dragged on. Hey, Skippy, you said one of the planets here is rocky? That just means it has a solid surface, right? It doesn't mean it has to be a lifeless rock like Mercury. Correct. Rocky also does not mean it can beat up other planets in a fight. Wow, look at you showing off your pop culture knowledge, I chuckled. The other two planets here are like Neptune in your home solar system. They are smallish gas giants, no large rings around either of them. How could something giant also be described as smallish? I let it slide, because that is something Skippy could easily spend half an hour arguing about. The rocky one, is it livable? That would be a resounding no, Joe. True, it is at a distance from the star where surface temperature might be considered habitable for carbon and water-based life forms, a distance your species calls the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold. That's a good description, by the way. I'm going to keep using it. Huh. Something useful from monkeys. Who'd have thunk it, huh? Although, when you think about it, Goldilocks was a bit of a dim-witted biatch. Who falls asleep in a house owned by bears? Why would they need to eat bland porridge when they could eat her for dinner? The story illustrates a good point, but it makes no sense at all. Now, there are human fairy tales I find sensible, although they are, of course, all somewhat fanciful, being...
Skippy?
Yeah?
This rocky planet. It's not livable?
I was getting to that.
Where was I?
Oh, yeah. Livable planets around red dwarf stars are exceedingly rare in this galaxy. Because red dwarf stars emit very low energy, a planet has to be so close to the star to be warm enough for supporting life that its surface becomes tidally locked. That means, like your moon, one side always faces the object it is orbiting. One side of the planet is warm, but the other side is frozen solid, so cold that any atmosphere might freeze and fall to the surface as snow. And red dwarfs are highly variable. The amount of light they emit can dim substantially for lengthy periods. Other times they can throw out large solar flares, strong enough to burn off the atmosphere of any rocky planet over time.
Got it. I will scratch red dwarves off any future house hunting trips. A wise choice.
Hey, talking about dwarves reminds me of a fairy tale.
I let him ramble on. It kept him busy and helped me pass the time while waiting for the flower to return.
Return it did, exactly on time. We had allotted 40 minutes for the mission, jump out to return jump. If it had been late, we were jumping the Dutchman in close enough to find out what happened. If the flower had returned early, we'd assume she had hostile ships on her tail. Neither happened.
Dutchman, this is the flower, Chang said.
Success. We found an artificial structure on one of the moons, right where Mr. Skippy thought it would be.
Told you so, Skippy said smugly.
For a change, I ignored the arrogant little beer can.
That is good news, Flower. Transfer navigation control to Skippy so we can take you aboard ASAP.
Roger that, Dutchman.
The good news was that a task force of Krestang ships didn't jump in while we were exploring this Elder Site. And this time, the Elder Site was intact. There wasn't a big hole scooped out of it. The bad news was it was empty. The site was a single building, and it was literally empty. Skippy said it apparently was some sort of monitoring station. Inside the building were racks and brackets for equipment, but it was all gone. Nothing had been damaged like you would expect if the place had been looted. It looked as if the elders themselves had removed the equipment. They had even closed the door when they left. It was a disappointment to the science team. Skippy was pleased that he had been right about an elder site being there. After the first set of sites where Skippy had thought we might find unmapped elder sites, we set course for the next potential site. This journey was going to take almost 5 weeks, because we had to go through 3 wormholes that weren't easily connected to each other. After the disappointment of not finding a comm node at several sites already, I was very much not looking forward to 5 freaking weeks of boredom. The science team was happy, busy, enthralled by poring over the mountain of data we had collected already. Skippy was in a bad mood, not his usual jovial self. He was pissed off by our failures to find a magical radio and frustrated and puzzled by not understanding why one site had been replaced by a perfectly scooped out hole. The people who were seriously bored were the pilots and the spec ops teams. For the pilots, the next 5 weeks would be no more interesting than flying a shuttle run from D.C. to New York and back. Other than us trying to program a couple jumps on our own each week, the only thing the pilots had to look forward to were combat simulations and simulating landings with our Theranan dropships. The Spec Ops teams had nothing to do other than training over and over. Considering that I'd made it perfectly clear I wished to avoid combat, the highlight of the next month for the Special Forces was a cooking contest. I seriously needed to do something about morale. Maybe a basketball tournament, one of the few sports we could play in our small gym. Exercising in the gym helped keep my sanity. I was on my way there one morning when I stopped in the middle of the corridor.
Ah, damn it.
What is it, Joe? Skippy asked.
I'm monitoring all ship functions and everything is operating nominally at the moment.
Nah, it's nothing. I forgot something, that's all.
Damn it. Did you forget to pick up your mother at the airport before we left Earth? I'm sure she's gotten a ride by now. Or she walked home. Kind of too late now.
No, Skippy, I did not forget her at the airport.
This time. Oh, that was one freaking time.
Pretty impressive there, Joe. Most people go their whole lives without leaving a close relative stuck at an airport for 5 hours. You did that when you were only 17.
You were a precocious disappointment.
That happened one freaking time, and I'll never hear the end of it. It was Amanda's fault anyway. If she hadn't distracted me...
Thinking with the wrong head, huh?
Skippy, I was a young, stupid kid back then.
Huh? You're under the illusion that you are different now?
Yeah. I'm not as young. Anyway, I inherited that forgetfulness. When I was 7 years old, my father took me to a Red Sox game at Fenway Park. After the game, he used the bathroom while I went to go buy a t-shirt, and he forgot about me. He was back across the main state line before he realized I wasn't in the car.
Huh. This story I haven't heard. What happened?
Standing in the corridor aboard the Flying Dutchman, I could remember that day like it was yesterday. I waited on Boylston Street. Anybody who saw me probably figured my old man was drinking in a bar and told me to stand outside. I remember a peanut vendor gave me a free bag of peanuts. He must have felt sorry for me. Anyway, after a couple hours, it's really dark and it's getting chilly. This was in early June. My father's car pulls up, and all he says is, "There you are!" I got in and we drove to my uncle's place in Brunswick for the night.
That's a good story. How come I didn't hear that before?
How did you hear about me forgetting my mother at the Bangor Airport?
Your mother talked about it to her sister while you were home right before we went up to the Dutchman. I was listening to everyone at that party.
That was a good party, I said sadly, thinking back to the last day I was on Earth. Maybe 100 people had stopped by my parents' house that afternoon, excited to see someone who had returned from the stars. They all wanted to see Barney Bishop again, and I didn't mind people in my hometown calling me that. And to keep things as low-key as possible, our Theranan dropship had landed in the road right in front of my parents' house. I had called my parents from Paris, saying that I would be dropping by for a short visit, staying over only one night. Sergeant Kendall and 2 people of her Air Force security team accompanied me. I slept that night on a couch in my parents' house, while the security people overnighted in the back of a National Guard truck in the driveway. Skippy by that time was already back aboard the Dutchman, getting the ship ready for departure, and remotely flying dropships to bring supplies up into orbit. To say that I slept on the couch was an exaggeration. I only managed maybe 3 hours of shut-eye that night. There had been too many people who wanted to meet me, talk with me, and too many questions. Questions about what I had been doing. What was going on with UNEF on Paradise, and what lay in Earth's future. The Kristang no longer had Earth under their iron grip, but people knew there were plenty more Kristang in the galaxy, and a Theranan ship hung low in orbit, and the Ruha was still out there also. To answer all those questions, I had a lame cover story that UNEF and the U.S. government wanted me to stick closely to. Before I left Paris, I'd been forced to endure a 4-hour briefing, including a mock question and answer session. By the time I was done, my head was spinning so much that I had a hard time remembering which was the cover story and which was the truth. The cover story was that I and a few other UNEF soldiers had been brought back to Earth on a Theranan star carrier for some mission that I couldn't talk about. When we got home, the Theranan learned the Kristang had been abusing an ally, so the Theranan took appropriate action and wiped the Kristang out. My being on Earth was a quick visit. I needed to get back aboard the Theranan ship to continue our voyage to wherever we were going, which was top secret. The UN Expeditionary Force on Paradise was doing great. Communications between Paradise and Earth were spotty because of enemy activity, but there was nothing to worry about. Everything was wonderful. Earth was safe. And every morning people would wake up to sunshine and birds singing. Was some BS like that. I tried to stick to the script as much as possible, with Sergeant Kendall watching me like a hawk. For her sake, I was on my best behavior, because while I would be leaving Earth, she would be stuck behind with the consequences. Either I sucked at lying, or my parents simply knew me too well. My story didn't convince them. They knew not to ask too many questions. I could see it in their eyes. The next morning, my mother left the table at breakfast because she was crying too much. My father took me out in the field behind the house, supposedly to show me how he'd modified the tractor to run on homebrew wood alcohol.
"Son," he said, with his head half under the engine cover, "I don't know what the real situation is, and I'm not going to ask you to tell me. You're wearing sergeant stripes now, and I heard one of those Air Force security people call you Colonel last night. Whatever is going on, know that your mother and I are damn proud of you. I have only one question I'd like you to answer." He pulled his head out of the engine cover and looked me straight in the eye, with a glance over at Sergeant Kendall, who was standing a discreet distance away.
Are we safe now from those damned lizards? And the hamsters? And whoever else is out there?
Yes, Dad. I can't tell you why or how.
Good. He breathed a sigh of relief.
Good, I said, not knowing what else to say.
Sergeant Kendall cleared her throat meaningfully with a look at the dropship.
It was time to go.
You did a good job on the tractor there.
Yeah? We're getting gas supplies again. It's rationed, of course. And electricity, you saw that.
Yeah. Looks good.
My parents' house had lights all night again. Things were getting back to normal on Earth. That was worth fighting for.
Dad, I have to go.
Yeah, I suppose you do.
He stuck out his hand awkwardly, his jaw set.
That's the way it had always been in our family. We didn't talk about things.
Good visit. Thanks for coming home.
I'd been through too much to go for that bullshit again. Not this time. Not again.
I took my father's hand, then pulled him in for a back-thumping hug. And I cried. He cried, too.
Ah, shit on a shingle, he said after we separated, and he wiped his eyes with the back of his flannel sleeve.
You'll let us know what you're doing, when you can.
Sure thing, Dad. You can count on it.
So, what did you forget? Skippy asked, bringing me back to the present.
What?
I was still thinking of my last day on Earth.
Damn, you are forgetful, Skippy scoffed. You stopped in the middle of the corridor because you said you forgot something.
Oh. I forgot my weightlifting gloves. That's all.
That night, or actually early the next morning, I awoke with a sudden jerk. Not the kind of thing where when you fall in asleep and your leg jerks by itself. I hate that. This was me, soundly asleep, having a dream, when my subconscious rudely pulled me out of it. For a moment, I froze in shock, wondering if something had happened to the ship.
No. No alarms, no beeping from my Z-phone, no Skippy shouting at me through the speaker in the ceiling. It wasn't the curry I had for dinner the previous night either. That was delicious.
Then it hit me. An idea. I had thought of an idea while I was sleeping. I rolled out of bed and began pulling pants and a shirt on, after glancing at my iPad for the uniform of the day.
Damn. It was 0337 in the morning, ship time. Sometimes I wish my stupid brain would just let me sleep.
Hey, Skippy, you awake?
Always.
Well, that must have been quite a dream. You woke up fast.
Whatever I'd been dreaming about, it was gone now.
Yeah. Hey, that map you showed us, of why it's going to take us 5 weeks to get to the next potential Elder site. Can you show me that again on my iPad?
Done.
Why, you checking my math in the middle of the night? Like that's ever going to happen.
No, I'm checking your logic.
Skippy snorted.
Wow. You sure you're not still dreaming?
Me? A flaw in my logic?
Not a flaw, a gap.
I looked at the map. On the 2D surface of an iPad display, it wasn't as impressive or easy to understand as on the 3D displays of the ship's bridge. There was no sense of depth. When Skippy first showed us star maps, I thought the 3D effect was nice but not necessary because the Milky Way galaxy is a disk, so not seeing the thickness of the disk didn't matter much. I was wrong. At any scale other than looking at the entire galaxy from far, far away, it sure does matter, because the arms of the Milky Way's disk are thousands of light-years thick, top to bottom. The Dutchman's current position was in the Orion Spur, about 600 light-years from the Gum Nebula. Yeah, that kind of description didn't used to mean much to me either, back when stars were something I only saw from Earth's surface. I touched the iPad display and zoomed in the view with my fingertips. Wormholes now appeared, scattered here and there at random, the wormholes showing as blinking purple lights. I touched a wormhole symbol, and a dotted purple line appeared showing which other wormhole it connected to. Skippy had a way on the main bridge display of showing all wormhole connections in the local area. I didn't need that at the moment. Some wormholes connected to a wormhole only a dozen or so light-years away, a few connected points thousands of light-years apart. The furthest Skippy knew of was a wormhole that connected to a wormhole 7,000 light-years from the Sagittarius Dwarf Galaxy, a distance of 55,000 light-years from its origin wormhole in the Perseus arm of the Milky Way.
Why that particular wormhole ended thousands of light-years from the closest star, no one knew. The average was around 600 light-years. No one knew why one wormhole connected to another, for most wormhole connections went past wormholes they should logically connect to. Even Skippy didn't know, and not knowing frustrated the hell out of him. The arrangement of wormholes in the galaxy made no sense. That was an affront to Skippy's sense of how the Elders would have left things, and that left him wondering whether some unknown force had screwed with the Elder stuff after they left. Or worse, if what he thought he remembered about the Elders wasn't complete or true. "A gap," Skippy asked. "I'm intrigued by whatever your dumb-dumb monkey brain could possibly consider as a gap. Go on." "The problem is there are other potential Elder sites closer to us, but those sites aren't close to a wormhole, so we can't get there, right?" "Flawless logic with no gap so far. You got it, Captain Obvious." No way I was getting back to sleep now, so I pulled my boots on. "Tell me something, Captain Oblivious. We have our magic beanstalk, an Elder wormhole controller module, and a cargo bay, right? Are there any dormant wormholes you could open with the module that would create a shorter path to a potential Elder site? Or could you connect a nearby wormhole to a wormhole near some place we want to go instead of where it connects to now?" "Holy shit," he said slowly. That wasn't exactly an answer, Skippy. "Give me a moment, for crying out loud. I'm running through a ginormous data set here, ginormous even for me. This could take a while." Skippy's voice faded away, replaced by a rock and roll song. "Skippy, I was beginning to get worried." The music kept playing. "Skippy. Woo, that was a lot of data. Hey, I used 37% of my capacity that time. A new record." "What the hell was that?" I asked. "Huh?" "The music. Oh, that was Don't Stop Believin' by Journey. I thought you'd be lonely while I was crunching numbers." "Very thoughtful. You scared me. Don't do that again." "You didn't like DJ Skippy Skip and the Fresh Tunes? Hey, I'm banging out nothing but hits here, homeboy." I laughed in spite of my recent anxiety. "Another time, maybe. You said you crunched the numbers. And?" "Oh, happy day, the answer is yes. Damn it, I am a dumbass. I should have thought of this idea. Shown up by a monkey. How humiliating. Damn it, now I'd be embarrassed to contact the collective. They'd all laugh their asses off at me." "There are two sites we should check out less than 2 weeks away, if I reprogram an active wormhole to connect to a wormhole that has been long dormant. The problem is, I'll need to put the original wormhole back the way it was after we go through. Even then, somebody is going to notice there is something odd going on with wormholes in this sector." "That is actually a bonus, Skippy. Then the wormhole near Earth will not be the only strange-acting wormhole, and that makes it look less suspicious. The Theranin, or Max Ulks, or whoever, can chase their tails trying to figure out what's going on and take attention away from Earth. The Max Ulks are vaguely cat-like in appearance, but they do not have tails. It's an expression, Skippy." "Oh, so noted. Hey, Joe, we can, keep this between us, right? No need for the whole crew to know that I missed something super obvious." I hit the door button and stepped into the hallway, attaching the Z-phone earpiece. "Don't worry. Your secret is safe with me, Skippy. In private, of course, I'm going to bust your balls about it every chance I get. I would expect nothing less. A new course has been loaded into the navigation system." "Great. I'm going to the bridge. I'll notify the pilot." When I got to the bridge, Sergeant Adams was the duty officer, sitting in the command chair. The two pilots, a French woman and a Chinese man, were relaxed in their couches. It appeared they were running a flight simulation. According to the main bridge display, the jump engines had a 22% charge. There wasn't anything for the pilots, duty officer, or sensor team in the CIC to do for a long while. The Dutchman was hanging in deep interstellar space, 2.2 light-years from the nearest star system, a red dwarf star that was a dime a dozen in the galaxy, a star nobody would care about. "Captain on the bridge," called out someone in the CIC behind me. Adams turned the chair to face me.
"Good morning, Captain," she said while rubbing on one of her fingernails with a frown.
I blinked and opened my mouth, unsure what to say. Before we left Earth orbit, I told the crew to dispense with saluting and most formal military protocol. We were all going to be stuck in a can together for months, possibly years. Adams not saluting me, therefore, was not a problem. What surprised me
was seeing Sergeant Adams using nail polish and apparently fussing over her nails. She hadn't been wearing nail polish when we first met at the Cristang jail where she had been tortured and we were both scheduled to be executed. And we hadn't brought along any nail polish when we left Paradise. When we landed on Earth after the first day, she'd been taken away for a medical checkup and debriefing. I hadn't seen her again until the week before the Dutchman departed, a week in which everyone involved was frantically working 20-hour days to get the ship ready and supplies loaded and stowed away. If she had nail polish on then, or in the week since, I hadn't noticed. Most of the time I'd seen her, she'd been in the gym or in the cargo holds we were using for training. Neither of those places were good opportunities for me to observe her personal grooming habits. It wasn't that her wearing nail polish was a surprise. She was a woman, and women do that, even when they are tough-as-nails Marines. Maybe especially when a woman is a tough-as-nails Marine. She may feel a need to have something that is personal and feminine. I don't know. Women are still a mystery to me. Adams is an attractive woman, if I can say that without being creepy as her commanding officer. When I first met her, and all the way back to Earth, her hair had been kept cropped very close, almost shaved. Now her hair was loose, wavy sort of afro-type curls on top, short on the sides, and she had kind of a, I guess it was a lightning bolt or stripe or something, shaved into the right side. Also, when I'd first met her, busting her out of the Cristang jail, her naked back had been scarred from torture. We had never talked about how she had been abused by the Cristang. If she didn't want to talk about it, I wasn't going to push her. What I had seen was that she'd been in pain when working out in the gym back then, and she'd worn loose-fitting clothes. A couple days ago, I'd seen her in the gym wearing shorts and a tank top, and there were no scars on her skin. Dr. Skippy had taken care of her scars on the outside. Marine Corps doctors had cleared her to return to the Dutchman, telling me they were satisfied with her scars on the inside. I raised my eyebrows and glanced at her nails. Red? Is that official United States Marine Corps Red Adams? I knew she was a bit self-conscious about being the only United States Marine aboard the ship. She laughed.
No, sir, this is more of a coral red. The rest of me belongs to the Corps. This is for me. I just did my nails this morning, and I chipped this one already.
Looks good. I didn't know what else to say. How we doing? As the captain, I probably should have been more formal, requesting a sit rep or ship status. This is what happens when an Army infantry grunt gets put in command of a ship. The Army has boats, not ships. She pointed at the display. The last jump was successful. No unfriendlies detected. An hour ago, we went through a molecular hydrogen cloud. Skippy said the density was something like 3 million atoms per cubic centimeter, and that's unusual. No effect on the ship. That was our big excitement for the evening. Skippy's voice interrupted excitedly. Also, the gas cloud was 98% hydrogen and less than 2% helium. That is highly unusual in the interstellar medium. Typically, cool, dense areas of the ISM are comprised of...
Science team, Skippy. Please discuss that with the science team, I said while rolling my eyes, and Adam smiled.
Sure, if you enjoy being ignorant, Skippy. I'm not embracing ignorance and I'm not blowing you off. If you find this interesting, with your vast knowledge of the galaxy, then our science team will definitely be interested. I could listen to you, but I couldn't appreciate it the way the science team will.
Oh, I did think you were blowing me off. All right, I'll discuss this with the smarter monkeys.
Thank you, Skippy. Sergeant Adams, I am here to liven up your evening. You were the first to hear this. Skippy has rerun calculations of an optimal search pattern, and we will be able to cut weeks off the schedule. The two pilots had turned in their chair while Adams and I were talking. They both looked surprised to hear the news.
Skippy, is the new course loaded into the autopilot?
Affirmative, Skippy confirmed. It is labeled Jump Option Delta.
New calculations? Adams asked, with her own raised eyebrow.
She knew Skippy well enough to figure there was more to the story. She also knew not to ask.
A different approach, based on recently discovered information, I explained.
The information Skippy had discovered recently was me giving him an idea he should have thought of himself. That could stay between us.
I'll explain more in the staff meeting, a meeting that was the bane of my existence. We had a meeting of team leaders every other day. This required me to think of something new to say every other day. Something new to say on a ship where one day of cruising through interstellar space was like the day before and the next.
Aye, aye, Captain. We'll engage the new course when we jump next, Adams acknowledged. The jump coils will be fully charged in, she glanced at the main display, 1 hour and 37 minutes.
Great. I'm going to get coffee. Otherwise, I was going to fall back asleep.
Chapter 11
Skippy was super, extra, mega excited about the next site on his list. It was the location that he thought was almost certain to contain an Elder site. What interested me in this system was centered on a Class K orange star, about half the size of Earth's sun. It wasn't just another too common red dwarf. Skippy was fairly bursting with confidence because this star system, with its location in the Orion Spur near Damaran's Nebula, was perfectly situated for an Elder communications node. That was because of invisible force lines in the galaxy, or some sciencey BS like that Skippy had made a futile attempt to explain to me. We found the star system. We did not find any sign of an Elder facility, or any sign an Elder facility had ever been there. After 4 days of intensive scanning, Skippy was frustrated and sounded depressed.
That makes absolutely zero freaking sense. Zero. I've proven that my model for predicting unknown Elder sites is valid. If any place should have an Elder site, it's this star system. I do not understand this at all. A moon orbiting this gas giant is the perfect place. There should be an Elder facility here.
Should we keep looking, Skippy? Maybe there is another Elder facility somewhere else in this system.
Unlikely, he said sourly, disappointment clear in his voice.
Oh, what the hell, sure, why not? Maybe there's some unknown minor factor that I'm not taking into account. Do you mind if we take the ship around the system for a week or so? I want to make some very detailed sensor readings.
We'll go wherever you want, Skippy.
Really?
He sounded surprised.
Yeah. Duh, you lunkhead. The whole reason we're out here is to find your magic freaking radio. We'll go wherever you think we need to go.
Within reason. I'm not endangering the crew without a damn good reason, you know that.
You want the Dutchman to hop around this system a couple days?
5 days. A week at the most.
No problem. This will be a good opportunity for training. You okay if we program some of the jumps?
He sighed.
In that case, better plan on 10 days, because we'll be so off target on every jump. You monkeys are lucky to hit the correct star system.
With the Flying Dutchman making short hops around the star system, the crew took the opportunity for extensive training that we couldn't do while the ship was traveling between stars. Pilots had fun flying dropships, flying the flower in simulated combat, and programming jumps on our own.
We were getting somewhat better at our jump accuracy, despite Skippy's constant mocking and complaining.
The science team, when not examining the sensor data Skippy was collecting, was also busy training. Mostly, their training involved how to use spacesuits without killing themselves. They also went through familiarization with ship systems they wouldn't normally have contact with, such as the sensor and weapons controls in the Combat Information Center. While I was duty officer on the bridge one day, 3 scientists got a tour of the CIC. It was a slow time for the bridge and CIC crews. All dropships were safely tucked into their landing bays, and the flower was attached to its platform for maintenance. There were not any crew outside the ship practicing spacewalks, and we weren't scheduled to jump again for another 3 hours. Sitting in the command chair, I was taking a quiz about the flight controls on the Theranan dropship, and hoping there would be good stuff left over for lunch in the galley when my shift ended at 1400 hours. One of the scientists, a Dr. Zheng, wandered away from the CIC and into the bridge. Sergeant Adams hurried over to shoo her away from me, but I signaled to Adams that I was fine with Zheng being there.
Dr. Zheng, you enjoying the tour? I asked.
She was a biologist and medical doctor. The ship's controls might have been less interesting to her than to others on the science team.
It is good to get out of the lab, she said with a smile. So far, the only places we've been to have been an abandoned space station and some airless moons. There has not been much for a biologist to do. I've been helping Major Sims in the hydroponics hold.
Before we left Earth, Sims had brought aboard experimental hydroponics equipment. I think it was something NASA had been playing with. We were growing fresh vegetables and fruit using hydroponics. Our first crop of spinach had been served in a salad 2 days ago. The space-grown spinach had tasted great to me.
When we came out here, I had hoped for greater opportunities to study alien biospheres, Zheng hinted.
Damn. One thing I was not in the mood for right then was an uncomfortable conversation.
Doctor, I did explain our situation, our mission, before we left orbit, I said gently, wishing to avoid an argument. Plus, I could empathize with her. She was bored, with few prospects of pursuing her life's work.
In fact, I argued against including a science team. You are not essential to the mission, and you are putting your lives at great risk being out here. As I told everyone who applied for the mission, it is unlikely, highly unlikely, that we will ever return to Earth. Even if the mission is concluded successfully, the ship could be stranded in deep space.
If Skippy leaves us?
Yes, I said simply.
Would you really do it?
She pointed to the self-destruct button on the left arm of the captain's chair, under its clear plastic protective cover with self-destruct in large red letters. To press the button, the duty officer needed to turn a lever that held the clear plastic cover down, flip the cover back out of the way, press the button once to activate, then hold the button down to confirm. At the same time, another officer in the CIC needed to do the same to the self-destruct button there. That was a precaution against accidents, or somebody going crazy. Precautions were all fine ideas, and assuring to the crew. In reality, Skippy wouldn't allow the nukes to detonate unless I ordered them to explode, and Skippy agreed.
Would you destroy the ship if we were stranded? Or if aliens were going to board the ship and learn humans are out here?
I do it without hesitation, I said grimly. Her raised eyebrows told me I'd surprised her, and not in a good way.
That's
without hesitation, because if I took time to think about it, I might not do it, I added. Army training is damned good. It not only trains you for what to do, it trains you to do it, no matter what the conditions. Trains you to do what you have to, even when you're tired, and you're hungry, and you're injured, and people are shooting at you. You've seen soldiers taking apart their weapons and putting them back together, over and over, blindfolded? She nodded. We do that so the action is in our muscle memory, and we don't have to think about it. It's like tying your shoes. You don't really need to think about it, right? You've done it so many times that your fingers know what to do.
I never thought about it like that.
I am not going to self-destruct the ship unless we absolutely have to. If we have to, I will do it. We can't allow our actions out here to put Earth at risk. I could see my little speech hadn't helped her mood any, so I added, One thing I can tell you, Doctor, is that anything can happen out here. You may very well get an opportunity to study alien biology firsthand. She nodded silently, unconvinced. Sergeant Adams took that cue to usher her out of the bridge, and I went back to my dropship flight controls quiz. Or I tried to. Talking about self-destructing the ship had put a damper on my mood also. Now I was really hoping there was something good left in the galley when my shift ended. While the Dutchman hopped around the star system, I took the opportunity for real flight training, including my first solo flight in a dropship. Skippy announced that he grudgingly, reluctantly, had to concede that it was possible, although extremely unlikely, that I might be able to fly an actual dropship away from the Dutchman without immediately destroying both the dropship and the star carrier. For my first solo flight, he did request we first eject his escape pod out to a safe distance, a request I denied. The whole time I was flying, a simple loop around the Dutchman and back into the landing bay, he grumbled, second-guessed everything I did, and predicted doom for me and everyone aboard our starship. On my own, I got the dropship lined up to re-enter the landing bay and manually flew it in, using gentle, precise movements with the thrusters. While the Dutchman usually took control of dropships and guided them in, for pilot training we needed to learn how to handle the task manually. My first attempt to settle the dropship into the docking clamps missed by less than half a meter. Keep in mind, this smaller type of Theranin dropship was still almost 40 meters long and weighed more than a Boeing 767. It wasn't like flying a little Cessna. Even the smallest dropship needs the capability to drop down through an atmosphere without burning up from heat, plus the ability to lift itself, passengers and cargo all the way from the surface into orbit, and sometimes beyond. Even the incredibly advanced technology of the Theranin couldn't shrink a dropship to anything smaller than a medium-sized airliner on Earth.
Flying in the vacuum and zero gravity of interstellar space, the dropship still had substantial mass. When it got moving in the wrong direction, it took a lot of force from thrusters to correct its course. One little adjustment from me got the dot of light centered over the docking clamps in the cockpit display, and I pressed the button to engage the clamps. As the dropship was pulled down and secured, I announced, "Dutchman, this is Barney, down and secured. Powering down now." Barney was my stupid pilot call sign. I wanted something cool like Rocket Man. The problem with that notion was that traditionally pilots do not get to choose their own call signs. Your call sign is chosen for you by other pilots, and a request for anything too cool like Top Gun is immediately shot down by your fellow pilots. Barney was the least humiliating of my call sign options. I had to talk our pilot community out of calling me Buzzer. That was the name they wanted to give me because of the number of times the cockpit warning buzzer had gone off while I was flying. Stupid buzzer. I suspected that Skippy made the damn thing go off at random just to mess with me. Desai replied, "Barney, welcome back. Closing landing bay doors now." "Roger, Dutchman. How did I do?" Skippy answered before Desai could speak. "It is a miracle. Truly a freaking miracle. Barney, the fact that we all survived you flying on your own is compelling evidence of divine intervention."
"You did just fine, Colonel Bishop," Desai assured me. "Your first solo flight was a success. You are ready for the next phase of training. We'll find a nice asteroid or small moon for you to land on somewhere."
"Great." I safed the controls and unstrapped from the seat. "Desai, after I finish dropship training, I can start learning about systems aboard the Flower?"
"Yes, sir. It is not that diff—"
she started to say. "What? Joe is going to try flying a starship?" "Oh, man, forget it," Skippy moaned. "The galaxy is doomed. Doomed! Look, you need to drop me off somewhere first. I'll put together a list of uninhabited planets." We stayed there for 9 days. It was 9 days of excellent training for the crew, and the science team got to pore over the super-detailed sensor data that Skippy was collecting. Skippy confirmed the star system was indeed a perfect location for an Elder comnode. He confirmed there absolutely should be an Elder facility there, and he also confirmed there was no sign the Elders had ever been there. For several days he was quiet, not making his usual snarky comments, not engaging me when I tried to provoke him. So I changed tactics and was extra nice to him. That may have helped, or maybe he perked up simply because we got to the next site, and he had something to occupy himself. The next star system we investigated was another disappointment. It was not a disappointment in terms of us not finding an Elder facility where Skippy predicted there should be one. It was not a disappointment in terms of the Elder site having been looted of all the valuable stuff long ago. It was a disappointment because the place was smashed to bits. This site, unlike most of the sites we'd seen so far, was not on an airless moon orbiting a gas giant planet. This site was on a planet, about half the size of Earth, that had a thin atmosphere composed mostly of carbon dioxide. From what we could detect from orbit, it was lifeless, unless there were organisms in the soil. The disappointment was caused by the fact that the Elders clearly had built a facility there, a large facility, and that the surface of the planet had been extensively bombarded by meteors. Skippy's analysis determined that this star system used to have a normal asteroid field, and that somehow the orbits of the asteroids had been disrupted to send rocks careening around the system. The two innermost planets, including the one with the Elder facility, had gotten seriously pounded over millions of years, and the bombardment was still continuing. "Is there anything left down there?" I asked hopefully. On the display, a map showed the original outlines of the Elder base. It had sprawled over 2 kilometers in diameter. Surely something that size could not have been completely wiped out of existence. "No," Skippy sighed. "There's a whole lot of nothing down there, Joe. A big meteor went splat practically right on top of the place about 3 or 4 million years ago, and there are impacts in the area before and after the big rock fell. Any Elder artifacts that survived the big impact would have been thrown far away. There is a debris field extending 300 kilometers from the impact site." 300 kilometers? I asked, astonished. "Meteors can be big, Joe. This planet has been hit many times by objects larger than the one that hit the Yucatan Peninsula on Earth and finished off the dinosaurs." "Damn. Are there any meteors or asteroids or whatever that will hit soon?"
I haven't completed a scan of the entire system yet. I can tell you there aren't any objects larger than a basketball that will impact within the next month.
Why, are you thinking of going down there?
Yeah. We can scan the surface, right? If we find any Elder stuff that's still intact, we should go check it out. Also, our pilot should get experience flying dropships in an atmosphere. This could also be a good place for practicing ground assaults. As long as we're here, we might as well take the opportunity. He sighed heavily.
Sure. Why not?
Listen, Skippy. I know you're disappointed. We all are.
Again, your method of predicting the location of Elder sites has been pretty damned accurate so far, right?
We're on the trail. It's only a matter of time now. The Dutchman stayed in orbit around the site for 7 days while we conducted extensive training. The science team was given permission to go down to the surface also, after I made them go through an hour of begging and whining about it. Dr. Zhang, the biologist, was super excited to find microorganisms in the soil. Skippy declared they didn't pose any threat to human biology, so I let her bring samples aboard the ship. Part of the training was for ground troops to test the portable shelters we'd constructed. Captain Smythe and his SAS team stayed overnight in shelters on the surface. They were scheduled to come back aboard in the morning, and I got up early to prepare a treat for them in the galley.
Crap!
Damn it, I wanted to make cinnamon rolls to go with breakfast, but this worthless dough isn't rising. I jiggled the bowl with the dough, as if that was going to help. The dough just sat there unhelpfully, looking stupid and uncooperative. Adams peered over the counter at the dough.
Smells good.
No, I had to admit, that's the cinnamon sugar mix I was going to put in. As a colonel, I should have been able to order the dough to rise. That hadn't worked.
Well, if this doesn't rise, maybe I can pass it off as cinnamon pita bread.
Adams laughed.
I don't think you're going to fool anyone with that.
It's your fault, Joe, Skippy said through a speaker. You didn't give the dough anything to feed on. You didn't use the sugar, like you were supposed to. There's plenty of sugar here, Skippy. I pointed to the plastic bowl of cinnamon and sugar next to the dough.
I mean you're supposed to put some sugar in the dough, dum-dum. The yeast eats the sugar and create gas that causes the dough to rise. Did you even read the instructions?
I said guiltily.
Sort of.
I had seen sugar in the recipe. The cinnamon rolls looked easy when my mother made them.
It's doomed, then?
Could be. I've performed a chemical analysis. It is possible you could still rescue that awful mess. Put some plastic wrap over the top, cover it with a towel, and put it near that heat lamp to your left. Not under the heat lamp, just near it.
Thanks, Skippy.
No problem. I calculate a 62% chance of success. Next time, read the recipe, huh? I can't do all of your thinking for you.
Skippy saved the day. The dough rose somewhat, and people loved the cinnamon rolls.
Sure, maybe they mostly liked the sweet icing I put on top. After Smythe's team came back aboard, we retrieved the dropships and jumped away to check out the next potential site. That was our sixth potential site we explored. I had lost track. The crew was exhausted from the grueling training we'd conducted. It was actually good that it was going to take us 2 weeks to get to the next target. People needed rest, and equipment needed maintenance. Skippy's mood could have used some improvement also. 3 days of stand-down rest left the crew refreshed, and we went back to a normal schedule. After the excitement of training on a planet, the crew and the science team were all eagerly anticipating what we would find next. I tried to temper their enthusiasm. What we didn't need was another disappointment sinking our morale. We needed diversions aboard the ship. I made plans to meet Major Sims at dinner to talk about what sort of fun we could have with the supplies she'd brought on board. The British team was cooking that day. It was something they called Sunday roast dinner, and it smelled delicious when I walked in the galley. Then I looked at it. There was some sort of green, wrinkly, stiff vegetable-looking thing on the side of my plate. And next to the roast chicken and Yorkshire pudding and the carrot and the scalloped potatoes, it was out of place, like someone had crumpled up a green napkin and left it there. Sims was sitting to my left. I whispered to her, keeping quiet to avoid insulting the British team.
Major, what is this? You ever been to a salad bar at a restaurant?
She asked quietly.
The salad stuff is in bowls. The bowls are on top of a bed of ice, and in between is this stuff.
A light bulb went on in my head.
Oh, yeah, I've seen this stuff.
With a fork, I poked at it. I thought that was plastic decoration. It was supposed to be lettuce or something. That stuff is real?